I'd like now to welcome to the program Norman Finkelstein. He is a political scientist. He is the author of many books, the latest of which is This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. He will be at the James A. Little Theater tomorrow night, Tuesday, December 6th, at 6:30, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. His talk will be followed by a conversation with Chris Hedges, and it's part of the Lannan Foundation series In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Your parents were both concentration camp survivors. Your mother was a great advocate of social justice for all people. And as a young man, you went to Palestine and formed lifelong relationships with Palestinian people. Tell us about that and how that process influenced your work as a scholar.
I went to Palestine for the first time in August 1988. It was a program called Eyewitness Israel. It was during the First Intifada, the first Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation. And I lived with a couple of Palestinian families. We were supposed to personally bear witness to the atrocities that Israel was committing during the First Intifada in order to repress it. And so I lived with one family in Hebron. The head of the household was a fellow, is a fellow named Musa Abu Heshesh. And I lived with a family in the Christian Palestinian village of Beit Sahur, which is outside Bethlehem. And the head of the household there was Nidal Barham. And I then returned every year for probably around 16 years and spent time with the families every summer until I was, a few years ago, I was barred from returning to the occupied territories.
By Israel?
Yeah, for 10 years.
You've spent a lot of time debunking the story that the land that became Israel was an uninhabited wilderness. Tell us the story of what in fact happened, the founding of Israel, what happened to the people who were there, and why there is any controversy about what happened.
Well, actually, it's not difficult to tell Americans the story of what happened in Palestine because it strongly resembles, in most of the fundamental features, it strongly resembles the dispossession, displacement of the native population of North America. Basically, foreign settlers came over. They claimed that the land was, to use the language of the U.S. history, they claimed it was a virgin land and a wilderness. Or in the Zionist case, the claim was a land without a people for a people without a land. Basically the same imagery, and then proceeded to dispossess and displace the indigenous population. In the case of North America, the process was much more brutal because the standards of the time were the moral standards of the time were much lower. So in the case of North America, there was a large element of not just displacement and dispossession, but there was a large element of extermination. In the case of Palestine, there were large-scale massacres and, of course, a quite comprehensive ethnic cleansing in 1948. But more overall, you could say the processes strongly resembled each other.
I was thinking about that because I read that in your work. And, you know, here we are sitting in New Mexico on what was really not that long ago Indian land. And it seems that, and I'm, you know, I live in a house. I'm not going to give up my house. And it seems that the process of illegal settlements is very similar. Like if you just stay there long enough, then the original owners of it can never have it back.
You know, those are complicated questions about how the rights of refugees metamorphose over time. Right now, the consensus among international human rights organizations as well as political bodies like the UN General Assembly, the consensus is that there has to be, and now I'm using the language of the UN resolution, there has to be a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. If you look at human rights organizations such as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, they say that the Palestinians who were forcibly removed from their homes in 1948 and 1967, and succeeding generations that have maintained genuine links with the land have the right to return. Now, exactly what that means is a practical matter. There's a certain amount of what you would call, I suppose, nebulousness to the formulation. But overall, the principle is fairly clear that those refugees have the right to return to their homes.
Let's go back to the period between World War II and 1967, when the Six-Day War, the Arab-Israeli War, happened. You describe in one of your books the way that the American Jewish community viewed Israel between World War II and the Six-Day War, and how that changed afterwards. What was going on there? What did that dynamic look like?
Well, the main concern was pretty straightforward. People, I think, sometimes overestimate the pull of ethnic bonds. They assume that if you're Jewish, your first loyalty is going to be to a Jewish state, or your first loyalty is going to be to your kith and kin in the Jewish state of Israel. But most Jews are like most people, which is to say, their first loyalty is to where they're enjoying, where they live, where they're enjoying their prosperity, so forth. In the case of American Jews after World War II, they were at the beginning of a fairly short process of entering the mainstream of the United States and acquiring great worldly success. Now, Jews as a whole have always been burdened with what's called the dual loyalty charge, namely that Jews aren't really loyal to their states where they have citizenship, but they're loyal to Jews, that there's an international Jewish conspiracy, or however you want to put it. Well, with the founding of Israel, all of a sudden, there was an institutional basis for this claim of dual loyalty, because Israel was claiming to be the state of the Jewish people, which would include American Jews. And so Jews were very wary about the creation of a state which was claiming their loyalty at the very moment that the state in which they enjoyed citizenship was giving them unparalleled, historically unprecedented opportunities for worldly success and worldly prosperity. And for that reason, American Jews kept Israel as at arm's length until 1967. In 1967, Israel, having defeated the Arab armies and, in effect, putting an end to what was called Nasserism, or radical Arab nationalism, Israel then became a strategic asset, as the language of the time put it, a strategic asset of the United States. And as a consequence of that fact, it was now safe to be pro-Israel because Israel was the United States' premier ally in the Middle East, beating back the Arab Third World hordes. And in fact, unlike the hapless Americans in Vietnam, the Israeli soldiers were even winning. And so with this combination, the fear of dual loyalty actually metamorphosed into the more loyal you were to Israel, the more loyal you were to the U.S., because Israel was on the front lines doing battle with the U.S.'s alleged enemies in the Arab world and Third World. And that's when the love affair began between American Jews and Israel.
Sorry for asking a dumb question, but why was the U.S. enemies with these various Arab countries? First of all, which countries did they consider their enemies, and why?
Well, because, first of all, it wasn't all the Arab countries. It was the Arab countries where there seemed to be popular governments, or relatively popular governments, which were calling for the control by the people of their own natural resources. So in the 1950s and 60s, the main adversary of the U.S. was Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser because of his rhetorical and also concrete support of what was called radical Arab nationalism, which was just a kind of bogey term. It simply meant the desire of the Arab people to control their own fate, future, and resources. And it was the defeat that Israel inflicted on Arab nationalism, radical Arab nationalism embodied in people like Nasser, which turned it into a strategic ally of the U.S. In later years, radical Arab nationalism came to be called radical Islamic fundamentalism, but it's the same principle. Back then it was Egypt that was the enemy, now it's Iran that's the enemy. But the same reason underlies the designation of both of them as enemies. Namely, they want to, in the case of Egypt, it was a combination of Egypt wanting to be a regional power and also for the region to control its own fate and future. In the case of Iran, it's Iran wanting to be a regional power and also having a strong hand in shaping the fate and future of the Muslim Arab world.
I think it's also worth noting that at the foundation of Israel, it was considered a leftist state, a socialist state, and during the McCarthy era, Americans, Jews and Gentiles alike, were distancing themselves from anything that was considered leftist or communist.
Right. That's actually an aspect of the dual loyalty, because it was not only a fear that Israel was claiming the loyalty of Jews around the world, including American Jews, but there was also the fear that Israel had, its history was closely aligned with the Second, the Socialist International, and the Third, the Communist International. The actual leadership of Israel, the Mapai, was quite close to the Second International, the Socialist International. And the main opposition party, Mapam, was very close to the Soviet Union. It was pretty much completely Stalinist. And so compounding the fear of the dual loyalty was the fact that the Cold War was just beginning. And the very last thing American Jews wanted to be associated with as the Cold War was opening up was not only a Jewish state, which was claiming its loyalty, but a Jewish state which also was at the left, to the far left end of the political spectrum.
There has been a kind of media depiction of reality that says that, well, the Israelis do terrible things to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians do even more terrible things to the Israelis. And I don't think it's fruitful to just add up numbers, but talk about the power imbalance historically and today, because without understanding the nature of that imbalance, it's really hard to understand the whole situation.
Well, there are questions always of the utility of numbers, but I do think that sometimes Jews and Jewish organizations have a double standard in this particular question, because on the one hand, they say every life counts, so why are we comparing numbers? But on the other hand, Jews are pretty emphatic on the 6 million number. And if you start playing around with that 6 million number, even lowering it to what's probably the realistic figure, about 5.3 million Jews were exterminated, between 5.1 and 5.3 million. The moment you lower the number by one digit, people start crying Holocaust denial and Holocaust revisionism. But then when you try, in the case of the Israel-Palestine conflict, to compare numbers, then all of a sudden numbers, absolute numbers, become unimportant and every life counts, so why are we counting numbers? the case of, say, the Israeli invasion of Gaza in 2008-09, about 1,400 Palestinians were killed, overwhelmingly civilians. In the case of Israel, 13 Israelis were killed. Of the 13 Israelis who were killed, 3 were civilians. Of the 10 soldiers, of the 9, it was either 9 or 10 soldiers who were killed, 6 of them were killed by friendly fire, that is, by other Israelis in war accidents on the battlefield. So the ratio was around 100 to 1. 100 to 1 is not a war. 100 to 1 is a massacre. And so I think the numbers are very revealing of the actuality of what happened there. There was no fog of war. There was no battlefield. It was just a massacre. As one soldier put it, I felt like a child with a magnifying glass burning ends.
And this is true at every level. When you look at the budget of the Israeli military, which is very much in large part funded by my tax dollars and yours, the United States, compared to what the Palestinians actually have, they're not even in the same ballpark.
It's silly to make any sorts of comparisons between the Palestinians and the Israelis on any level, whether it's economic or military. The Palestinian economy has been completely wrecked by a now more than 40-year-long occupation. And Israel is one of the has one of the highest living standards in the world now. And at all levels, there's just no, I think, sort of comparing apples and oranges. When you look at the accumulated arsenals on both sides, compare the GNPs on both sides, there is no basis for comparison.
To what extent has Israel used torture and other similar methods of harsh detention against Palestinian people historically and today?
It's a very long history at this point, so it's hard to give broad generalizations, but to speak to the more recent years, Israel was torturing to Palestinian detainees from immediately after the occupation's beginning in June 1967. During the First Intifada, the occupation had reached epidemic levels with all the human rights organizations, B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, B'Tselem, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, all of them saying that Israel was systematically, methodically torturing and ill-treating Palestinian detainees. By the years 1987 to 1993, several tens of thousands of Palestinians had been tortured in Israeli jails. The amount of torture by Israel had diminished, though it had not gone away. It had diminished after a 1999 Israeli Supreme Court ruling. There are recent years, there are reports still of torture being committed, but a lot of the torture has now been farmed out to the Palestinian Authority, which basically acts as Israel's collaborators, does a lot of the torture for them.
We're talking to Professor Norman Finkelstein. Who have been and are the allies of the Palestinians?
I think that's a difficult question to answer. There are, states have their own interests, and sometimes for raison d'etat, they support the Palestinians. The main ally of the Palestinians is the vast reservoir of public opinion that is ready to support a just settlement of the conflict. And it's that vast reservoir of public opinion that Palestinians have to tap into if they want to achieve a just resolution of the conflict. I think it's very difficult to rely on the consistency of states, because states have their own agenda.
working on a book called Knowing Too Much, Why the American Jewish Love Affair with Israel is Coming to an End. If that is indeed the case and that love affair is coming to an end, do you see that filtering up to American foreign policy?
I think that's a good question. And you know, everything depends on whether you turn public opinion into a political force. There is a strong Israel lobby, which is just paid agents for Israel. That's what a lobby does. There's a Cuba lobby, an Ireland lobby, you know, so there's an Israel lobby. But the Israel lobby on its peripheries included a large chunk of American Jewry, which is willing to go along with what Israel was doing or how Israel was carrying on. But in recent years, there's been a large disaffection of American Jews from Israel. And so there is a possibility of American Jews will speak out that they can neutralize the effects of the lobby, which is very powerful and very wealthy and very ruthless, but can neutralize the effects of the lobby and can hopefully create an opening in Congress and elsewhere for a fair hearing to a proposal to justly resolve the conflict.
Norman Finkelstein is a political scientist. His books have been translated into dozens of languages. The latest book is This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. He will be at the James A. Little Theater tomorrow night, Tuesday, December 6th at 6:30 in the evening, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation and in conversation with Chris Hedges. It's part of the Lannan Foundation series, In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Hirokazu Yoshikawa. He's Academic Dean of Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He's author of the book Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
So in all the media conversation about undocumented immigrants here in the United States, there is very little about their documentation status and how that affects their children. How did you come to write about immigration from this perspective?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't think in much of the public discussion about the undocumented as either lawbreakers or as victims that there's a recognition that they are parents who are raising 4.5 million citizen children in the United States. And this was not a topic that we expected the study to be all about when we started it. This was a study of hundreds of families in New York City, born in public hospitals there, and the book is part of a much larger study about culture and context and how they influence children's development in immigrant families. But basically, as they told their stories of immigration, this emerged as a very powerful theme. And it turns out that growing up with a parent without papers, these kids are at risk for lower cognitive development as early as at 24 months, simply because their parents have no papers and these kids are not accessing learning opportunities as a result.
You compare Dominican, Mexican, and Chinese families with small children. Why these three groups?
We happen to pick those three groups in New York City because they represent the majority of immigrant families in New York, and together they make up nearly half of the city's population. So that's basically why we picked the group. Now, it turns out their histories of when they started to come to New York and the proportions of undocumented parents among these groups are really different. With the Dominicans really starting to come in large waves about 50 or 60 years ago in New York. And so having much more multi-generational networks, ethnic enclaves that are really rich and provide a lot of support that have built up over decades, both the Mexicans and the low-income Chinese who have come as large recent waves of migration to New York City have been much higher proportions undocumented, coming largely after the 1986 to 88 Immigration Reform and Control Act, which was the last time that there was a pathway to citizenship for the undocumented. So for these groups, they have come, they're generally stable two-parent families, but they haven't had access to a pathway to citizenship.
You write about undocumented parents living a paradox, and that paradox is that the same government that can deport them also offers them services. Tell us about these services. Which ones are most effective for parents and their small children, and to what extent do undocumented parents access them for their citizen children?
Yeah, so hundreds of studies show that for kids in low-income families, a good center-based child care program in the first years of life can really improve their early learning, their language, literally can result in larger vocabularies. And the undocumented parents in our study were afraid to access child care subsidies, which would help them to pay for what's often very expensive center-based care. Any of your listeners who are listening who have young kids between the ages of 0 and 3 recognize how expensive a good child care program can be. And so the child care subsidies that would help these parents purchase good child care for their citizen children, they were afraid to sign their kids up for this because it would require reporting their earnings and identifying their employer often. So this was something that they were reluctant to do, despite the fact that their earnings were so low and would qualify their children for child care subsidies, and despite the fact that they were working usually 12-hour days, 6 days a week. That was a very typical scenario for our fathers or mothers in our sample.
Are there safeguards in, at least in New York and the places that you studied, so that if people want to access them, they're not in danger of being deported or turned in?
So New York City happens to be a sanctuary city, which means that local law enforcement officials don't stop parents simply by virtue of kind of suspicion of having come into the country outside the law or without papers. So New York, compared to many other policy contexts, and of course with states like Arizona and Georgia and other states in this country passing much harsher laws, we saw these really negative impacts on kids and higher parental stress and lower access to these resources and supports in a fairly generous policy environment. So I can only imagine that these patterns are worse in policy contexts that are harsher.
The whole issue of depression and anxiety and the effect of those things on small children, I think, is something one just doesn't think about if you're not in that world. Tell us about that. In other words, what are the people that you studied, what are they anxious and, well, I mean, it's kind of obvious, but explain to us, what are they anxious and depressed about, and how does that affect their small children?
I think what we see among undocumented families is this pileup of stress from both the economic conditions that they live under, which, you know, many, many families, certainly, especially right now in the United States, are feeling that kind of economic stress. So the day-to-day stresses of being able to make ends meet, of pinching pennies, of wondering whether the paycheck is going to last till the next one. These were part of the stresses. So those are kind of economic and financial stresses. But I think there was this kind of background hum in their lives, which was the fear of deportation and the recognition that they did not want to access formal institutions, public services. They were not using public services or programs that their children were eligible for. And in the case of a child care and center-based care, that ended up being to the detriment, you know, harming their children's early learning. So I think it's this combination of stress from living under the radar and the economic stresses of living in poverty, extremely long work hours. Between a third and 40% of these moms and dads were working under the minimum wage, working illegally low wages, working for years, often 12 or 15 years at the same job without getting a raise. So just to give an example, one of our Mexican dads who had been doing deliveries for a deli 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, had injured both of his knees through wintertime falls on the New York City ice. As his older kids got to the age where they understood what he did for work, he was ashamed to tell them that he was still a delivery boy after 12 years working for the same deli. This dad, like many undocumented parents, was paying taxes and waiting for a work visa, and of course there was none coming. He had not asked for a raise. So many of these parents, the employers are not giving them raises, but the workers are also not asking for raises. So there's a kind of a toxic relationship of indebtedness and exploitation in these workplaces, which ultimately is harmful for kids' development. So when a family's economic conditions are stagnant, with wages not changing for periods of 10, 12, 15 years, whether it's a recession or not, that is simply not good for kids' development.
We're talking to Hiro Yoshikawa about his book, Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. New Mexico is one of the few states that does offer driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. In other words, they're documented with identification from their own country, but they're not of green card status here.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to people who don't have driver's licenses in states that don't, which is almost every state of the country? How does that affect individuals and families not to have a driver's license?
So in other studies I've conducted, the role of having a driver's license and then a car and then a working car is the lifeline of low-wage work. So without that, in most areas of this country, you're simply dead in the water as far as access to any kind of choice, even within the low-wage job market. Certainly right now, many, many people are unemployed regardless of whether they have a car. But if there are jobs out there, if you don't have a car, you're not going to be able to access them. So this study, this current study that I did was conducted in New York City, which is a bit unusual in the sense that it has a very good public transportation system. But for the undocumented parents in our sample who were living outside of New York City, there was an additional layer of kind of isolation and almost desperation. So a parent who was basically stuck in a suburban house, her husband had a car, but she had none. And so she could not get out. She could not run any household errands without access to her husband's car. And so she had felt really quite sequestered and depressed as a result of that, because she herself could not drive. So a driver's license also has importance for accessing all kinds of resources. So for our parents, there was a combination of both not having these kinds of formal symbols of belonging in the United States, but also low levels of information. So a surprising number of our undocumented parents did not know about public libraries, for example, in their communities, didn't know about programs like Head Start, preschool programs for their kids that would improve their development. So in some cases, our interviewers were the first people to even tell these parents about the existence of things like public libraries.
What are the services that the people in your study did tend to access most?
So the undocumented parents in our study actually, interestingly, had the highest rates of church attendance. So they were attending church really regularly. So many of the countries from which undocumented parents come in Latin America or elsewhere, these are highly religious families where the families were going together to church on Sundays. So that was an aspect of their lives where they were, interestingly, even more connected than our documented parents. So there's a lot I talk at the end of the book about what we can all do to help the learning and the development of these citizen children. So 4.5 million citizen kids of the undocumented are key to the nation's economy. It's a large group. They're going to school right alongside all the other citizen kids in our country. So we really need to be concerned about their learning opportunities, particularly in the first years of life when brains are developing so quickly. So I think one way that we can think about this is through the community organizations that serve low-income immigrant families, and churches are really key to that. And to the degree that we can support the ability of churches and other local organizations to provide information, basic information that we take for granted, whether it's about public libraries or preschools or childcare, and then later on about the school systems and the basic information about how to navigate a public school system. These are things that can really make a difference for these kids.
There's also the WIC program, which I understand from your book is pretty well utilized.
In New York City, it was, and that was because I think the sign-up for this program was in the public hospitals. It was done right at the child's birth by social workers. It was done very quickly at the time that health insurance coverage was being assessed. And that's a real no-brainer from a policy perspective in that the WIC program improves infant health, reduces neonatal problems, reduces infant mortality, pays for itself in terms of its benefits to society. So it is very important that these kids access WIC. But that might not be true in other parts of the country. So I would just put in a caution there that in New York City, where we collected the data, it happened to be these hospitals were very effective at signing these families up for WIC, but that might not be true everywhere.
Undocumented workers tend to do what you call the worst jobs in urban America. Long hours, as you've talked about, rough working conditions, low wages, sometimes wage theft. They're working below the minimum wage, which is not legal, but they're afraid to say anything. To what extent are they able to get any kind of worker protection to join unions? And to what extent are they able to advance into better jobs?
So in our study, they were not advancing into any better jobs within even a fairly restricted workplace as far as income, like a restaurant. They were generally working the very lowest tier of jobs without the possibility of moving up, even within that kind of environment. Now, of course, in different parts of the country, these jobs are really different, but the evidence shows that these are national studies, not the study that I conducted, but the national studies show that the undocumented in every industry are at the very bottom. So in construction, they are doing the drywall installation. They're doing the jobs where they are receiving instructions but not having reciprocal interactions with very much with coworkers or supervisors. So they do not have the access to developing new skills generally at jobs. They cannot sit for GEDs. They don't qualify for federal workforce assistance or job training. So this is a population that our national public policies exclude from workforce development and the opportunity to better their lives. Now, they themselves are, of course, undocumented. In the book, I show that what the consequences are for their citizen children. As far as unionization goes, that's been difficult in New York City with low-income immigrant workers, but it really varies in different parts of the country. So Los Angeles is a historically very well-known example of a place where in a city, occupations like janitors, low-income, low-wage jobs with high concentrations of low-income immigrants, there have been successful unionization efforts.
The book focuses on how all of this affects their children, and I think it's important to talk specifically about what happens between the ages of 0 and 3 or 4 years old when kids don't get the stimulation and nurturing that they need?
Yeah, so literally their vocabularies are smaller, which places them at risk for problems right at school entry, but even on into later schooling. What we know from national data suggests that these kids are particularly likely to go into lower quality schools, lower resourced schools in low income neighborhoods. So their prospects are really not good in terms of their long term school success. And this is a period when the development of brain architecture is extremely critical. If you don't have those foundations well laid down solidly with these indicators like early language development, then there's long-term risks for these kids' school success and even their employability and job success in the future. So the larger economic context for this concern is that we as a country can't afford to be writing off millions of citizen children simply because their parents have no papers. So at a time when our economy is aging so rapidly, And we really need to maximize the potential of every kid to help support the rest of us. As we get older, this is a population we really need to pay some attention to.
We're talking to Hiro Yoshikawa about the book Immigrants Raising Children. When you compared the children of documented immigrants and undocumented immigrants specifically, did you find out that, I mean, both of them doing perhaps pretty rough jobs, did the kids of immigrants with papers end up doing better?
Yes, the evidence from this study suggests that they did. It is because even though our entire sample was low income, and so even, let's say, comparing the jobs, all of our parents were in the low-wage workforce. The rates of illegally low wages were much higher among the undocumented parents. So that's one indicator. As I said before, the access to childcare subsidies. So if you simply looked at the parents who had already chosen to put their children into center-based care, the undocumented parents still had much, much lower rates of use of access to child care subsidies. So those are two of the indicators that were really of concern for these families. And as we also talked about a little bit, the levels of stress also seem to be different. And I think it is because it's the combination of the stress from economic conditions and pretty deep poverty. But on top of that, the stresses of living under the radar and being undocumented in the United States.
You know, just knowing that ICE can come and knock on your door and take you away at any moment is, depending on when the last time it was that it happened in your community, a high or medium low-level stress all the time.
That's right. And I think other studies, we had... thankfully, very few reports of actual deportation or knowing someone who was deported, but our study was conducted several years ago, and so now we know that rates of deportation have increased in this country, and so many more immigrant families know someone or have themselves experienced deportation. And there have been a couple studies of that experience and its effects on families and children, and the effects, of course, on the economic conditions of an arrest like that because of the loss of income are drastic. So families losing 100% of their income or half their income overnight. But then the level of fear in these families and the rates of keeping children at home, in that case, very high rates of kind of behavior problems, anxiety problems in the kids are a huge issue for those families that are directly affected by deportation. And for those who aren't affected, there is still this sense of the fear of what might happen.
To what extent do extended families, grandmothers and grandfathers and aunts and uncles and so on, make up for a lot of these other problems that come with... long hours and lack of resources and things like that?
Yeah, so extended families and, in fact, friendships can make a huge difference, and grandparents, of course. And what was interesting was that our groups that had the highest rates of undocumented status, which were, again, the most recent low-income waves of migration from Mexico and China to New York City, because they had come, they had... As immigrant groups, they had just started coming in the early 90s, our parents were often the first people in their families to come. And because they were unable to get green cards or have any kind of sponsoring role, they could not bring their own parents, who would be the grandparents of the kids, over. So they were much less likely to have grandparents in the home than, for example, our Dominican families. So there was kind of a double whammy of not having access to grandparents. The undocumented families often were doubled up just to make ends meet in a really expensive city, and so they had more adults in the home, but paradoxically less support available to help with their kids. So when we asked questions, you know, who do you have in your, who you know who could help with taking care of your child if you had to go away for a couple of days, help with finding a job, help making ends meet. Our undocumented families, despite having more adults in the home, had lower levels of that kind of support. And that's because they didn't have the kinds of folks like grandparents who might have the time and the dedication to take care of their kids. The other adults in their households were often other undocumented young adults working those very, very long work hours. So it was no wonder they were unavailable to help our parents.
Now, my own grandparents came to the United States from Sicily in the first part of the 20th century. My grandparents, all of their brothers and sisters, all of them made it. It wasn't easy, but all of them made it. My father went to college, and basically any of their kids who wanted to did go to college. So some did, a lot didn't. What's the difference between that era and today? This is also New York City. What is similar? What is different?
Yeah, in some ways there are certainly parallels. In every age, we have the low income, often marginalized group that has come in. So certainly the marginalized immigrant groups at in the first decades of the 20th century were from Southern Europe, from Italy, from Ireland, from Eastern Europe. They were discriminated against. Their experiences were what led to the labor laws, for example, of this country. So the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, in which over 140 primarily immigrant young women died, was one instance of terrible work conditions leading to public policy change. So one way in which things should have changed for the better is that we now have some public policies like laws governing workplace violations, and yet we find that workplace violations are still rampant for the population of undocumented immigrant workers in this country, and that's a major problem that needs to be fixed. The other thing is that in doing the research for this book, I learned that the category of undocumented or illegal immigrant was invented in 1888 under the Chinese Exclusion Act, singling out a single ethnic group for this status. And so for much of the development of this country, there was no such category as illegal immigrant.
If you could just basically wave a magic wand and have immigration policy, just on simply the level of what happens to immigrants' documentation status, things like that, when they do get here, especially from the perspective of helping future citizens, if you could change that to be something which you think is really reasonable, what would it look like?
So one option would be what President George W. Bush proposed in 2006, which is a pathway to citizenship for families who have demonstrated a certain number of years of residence in the U.S. And by the way, all of our undocumented parents had been in the U.S. for multiple years before having their first child, so this was not an anchor baby situation. But then President Bush proposed, and many folks from across both parties in Congress at that point were in agreement that these parents would not go to the front of the line. They would go to the back of the line in terms of a wait for something like a green card. They would pay a fine. They would demonstrate that they had been working during their years in the U.S., as the vast majority of the undocumented are in fact doing, many of them paying taxes. So that's certainly a set of policies that was proposed seriously only 5 years ago.
Hirokazu Yoshikawa is Academic Dean of Education at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, and he's author of the new book, Immigrants Raising Citizens, Undocumented Parents and Their Young Children. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me. It was terrific.